Hello and welcome to Macro Moments. This morning we are having a literary conversation with Janani Durai and Ines Tan, who are both short story writers from Singapore. Janani, perhaps if you would like to tell us a bit about your book.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for having us today. So my book, Regrettable Things That Happened Yesterday, is a collection of 10 short stories that are loosely linked by this theme of newspapers. And they were all kind of conceived or written while I was a journalist. And while I didn't start out intending to write a collection about newspapers, it kind of just happened because I think it was kind of in my subconscious. So I wrote about half the stories before I realized that there was this link, and then I tried to make the link more intentional.
And Ines, you have a book that's coming up with Epigrip. Do you know when it's scheduled to come out?
September 2018.
And do you want to just tell us a little bit about it? Can you reveal the title?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having us both here, Mark. My book will be coming out in September 2018 from Epigram Books. The title is This Is Where I Won't Be Alone. It's a collection of short stories about home and belonging. And I got really excited for the collection when I thought about the title maybe 5 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And it comes from the song Home, the National Day
yeah,
song Home.
Yeah, I was going to ask about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Digley and cool. Kitchen. And I was searching for a phrase that would be familiar to Singaporeans and suggest something of home and belonging. And I like all that the title suggests. I think it suggests isolation and loneliness, but also a yearning for coming together and for intimacy and for belonging with other people in a place that feels like home. And that in the midst of feeling like not belonging, which more and more as I put together the book, I was realizing is a common experience for people in Singapore, especially if they've lived overseas for a while or even not always felt entirely at home in their own home.
Yeah.
So that's what that collection came to be around.
We are talking in a way about origins, about how you guys got started, you know, writing journeys, and the idea that language has power, power to move, power to create worlds, to affect people's lives. When was that first instance that you became aware of the power of language?
It's not like a first experience, but it was one that really stood out to me in recent years and was really pivotal, I think, in the last few years of becoming a writer. I took a college writing class, fiction workshop with Professor Andrew Barrett in my college. And we did a very early writing exercise, and I was just writing about these sort of mean high school girls in a cafeteria kind of being mean to one another. And I just wanted everything in the scene to be kind of mean and catty. And without really thinking about it, I was describing what they were eating in the cafeteria, and I said there were these brownies the size of kitchen sponges. And I really just did it to think about the size of the brownies.
Yeah.
And Andrew pointed out and said, you know, this is a great description because it's like you're associating brownies with everything gross about a sponge, with these germs and washing up and grossness. And that had never occurred to me. It was something I guess I did and didn't know about that was there in the language. And that's the sort of thing I always try to point out to my students when I teach creative writing. When you're doing something and you don't even realize you're doing it, but you're bringing all these associations in with the language. So that was a pretty major experience, and I think since then has made me a lot more careful about choosing every single word and thinking about what that brings with it, with the language.
When I was a kid, I was obviously, you know, like probably like Inez as well, a big reader, but I was reading believing that authors wrote purely for my entertainment, and I never really thought about how words could have any kind of power. So I had a very, I would say, religious experience when I was like 10 and I read A Wrinkle in Time. And for some reason, that book really like blew my mind. And when I, after I finished reading it, I literally sat there and told my mother the whole story. And then I started writing. And I wrote the entire story. I changed all the names. And I changed, like, there was something at the end where, like, love is the answer. I changed it to joy because I was like, you know, why not? And then I gave it to my mom because I was so proud of myself. And she was like, this sounds exactly like that book you read. And I was like, no, it isn't. It's different. Did you see the last part? It's joy, not love. And I still do not know why I did this, but it was like, I was so enamored by this book. It was almost like I so wanted to have written it first, almost. And so I think that kind of started this whole, my kind of like lifelong, you know, desire to produce something, something like that, something, a work of literature that would blow people's minds. Obviously, I'm nowhere close to that, but that was, I think, what started my journey as a writer.
Well, I have a question here. That what's the first book that made you cry?
Yeah.
Did A Wrinkle in Time make you cry?
No, because it was just amazing.
No, just a glorious, joyful experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does writing energize you or exhaust you?
I don't think I write emotionally draining books yet, but yeah, I mean, I would say probably a little bit of both, alternately both, when depends on the day. I kind of do think of it as exercise, kind of like something that I do need to do every day and not always something I want to do, but I never regret having done it, even no matter whether the end result was exhaustion or energy.
So you do have a writing routine that you try to keep to?
Yeah. Well, I try to keep it.
Like exercise.
Yeah, exactly. Some days it falls by the wayside, but you know, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think exercise and writing is an apt comparison.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, like I tell my students, which means I tell myself that like you're always better for having done it than not.
Yeah.
And even like however little is better than nothing at all.
Yeah.
For back to the sort of like energizing, exhausting question, I think it's both, often at the same time.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, for me, when I'm really deep in a story, which kind of takes a while, and just being in it to the point where you almost dream of it, you wake up or it, or when I find myself thinking of the story, when I'm not thinking of the story, I know that I'm really deep in it. I can think of an example from the first story in my upcoming collection called Edison and Curie, which is about two twins and JC trying to survive their education. There's a scene where those two girls are friends, and one of them rolls down her sock, her school uniform, rolls down her sock to reveal that she's been cutting herself, and it's there on her ankle. And the paragraph was fine. I had that for years and thought, you know, this is what it should be. And then one day when I was deep in editing final edits, it just occurred to me, what she needs to do is she needs to roll down the school logo on her sock. Because so much of that story was about trying to appear successful. You're in this elite situation, you're in this wonderful school, you're just as good as everybody else. And so the idea of looking at the logo and the sock and unrolling that to reveal the pain and the struggle underneath it was what I really wanted to see in that scene. And so I added in, you know, the school logo on the sock, which was a small thing. But I think that's the sort of sweet spot of exhausting and energizing when you're thinking about it, even when you're not thinking about it.
And what I've felt also in both of your writing is that there's a strong grounding in the emotional life of your characters. Do you think that somebody could be a writer if they didn't feel emotion strongly?
I think everybody feels strong emotions about something. I think as a beginning writer, especially for me, it was something that I couldn't access directly. So I think about one of my stories called On the Moon, which is set on the moon. It's about people on the moon. And it started as sort of a writing class imitation of a story called On the Show, which was about people working at a fairground, you know, a carnival, and just sort of a big survey of all the people and what a day looked like for them. Mm-hmm. So I started On the Moon because I thought, well, I guess I like the moon. The moon is with me wherever I go. I can think of a lot of things that would happen on the moon to set a story in. And as I began to populate the moon, and I sort of imagined who I thought would be on the moon. Like, there are these scientists. There's a woman who breeds dogs that power the moon and generate electricity. This was a little wishful thinking on my part,
but
I thought I would...
Right?
On treadmills, yeah.
Yes.
I thought I would... Whoever I want on the moon. Dogs on treadmills. And as I started sort of writing the stories of the people I thought were there, it became very much a story about home and belonging and making your home somewhere where it wasn't before and trying to make the most of that and missing another place and missing the people you'd left. So I think it's something I could never have written if I had approached it directly. I think for early writers, it can help to focus your attention on something else and sort of see where that leads you.
Yeah, I liked your question because I feel like a big flaw of mine is that I feel everything too strongly. So I was hoping that, you know, maybe that, yeah, that made me a better writer. But so, I mean, what is it necessary? I mean, I would say maybe, because I mean, definitely empathy is a prerequisite, right? You need to be able to kind of imagine life through somebody else's eyes and to be able to feel things as they're feeling it, because otherwise you don't really get your readers to feel what they're feeling.
Like A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes.
Why short stories for the both of you?
Edgar Allan Poe said about poems that they have something called totality of effect, and all he meant was that they're short. So when you look at them on the page, you can kind of take it all in at once, and you can get a whole sense of the effect that's going on. So I think short stories are really good for doing that in fiction. A sudden moment where you thought the story was going one way, and then it's going to turn and go another way. I think that's really present in a lot of Jenna New stories, actually, where it seems to me that there's in a lot of them, in the best possible way, there's a late moment where a twist happens in the story, and you see where something was inevitably heading and surprising at the same time. I can think of a story where I really was trying to go about that with the ending. Again, Edison and Curie, the first story in the collection. It actually begins with the most pivotal moment, in a way. It begins with Edison, one of the twins, standing up in a lecture theater in JC and slashing both his wrists. And that happens on page one or two. And that was sort of where everything was headed. So the story backtracks and it shows everything that led him and his sister kind of up to that moment. And for a while I thought that was kind of all the story was going to do. We got to this most climactic moment. That's it. And then I, the more I thought about it, I thought that's not quite the ending place for it. Nothing surprises you in the story if all that happens is that. So it took years to get to where the story finally ends, and it involved looking at a third sibling in the story who was not a major part to begin with, but the more I realized that everyone in that story needed to settle into their place, the more it was important for her to come to the forefront. So I think a short story was the medium for that. I think it would have lost some of that impact if it had been spread over a longer work.
So, any of your stories based on real people, real situations, and are they aware of that you're writing about them, or have you changed it, or you know, did you actually go to them and ask them for more information, a confirmation, affirmation?
Validation.
I think more people think the stories are based on them than is actually true. Yeah. I have so many texts from like family and no, not at all. Sorry that I used your very common name in this story. With PG-13, I did have a group of friends, and we had a pact to wait till the last one of us turned 13 to watch a movie, but nothing else about the situation was the same, you know? There was one I asked permission for. The story Revelation to Amala Rose, someone told me that story. A friend told me that story about an older lady in her church. And I asked her, is it okay if I write a story about this? And she was a little bit like hesitant. So I wrote it, but you know, none of the details. That was all. I imagined all the details, the character, everything that happened, and I sent it to her to just be like, I'm probably gonna try to send this out to get published. And she read it, and she said she liked it, and she didn't see any problem with it. So I did do that one for. Yeah.
I think I would say most of the stories in this collection started from something real in some small way, and then sort of went through fiction to become the stories that they are. You know, one story I can think about is the story called Oyster, which began when this really happened to me. My mom really gave me a bag of dried oysters when I was going back to Michigan, where I was living at the time. I said, like, no, I don't want them. I'm never going to cook them. She said, no, you got to take them. And so I took them with me. I put them in the fridge. I never cooked them, and like they became moldy, and I threw them away. That was it. And I tried to write it as a story, and it was so sad and boring. It was just draggy. It was exactly the story that had happened. But then I realized I could tell it from the oyster's point of view. And when I sort of looked at it from that way, it became kind of fascinating. I read about like where dried oysters come from. I thought about sort of the journeys they make transatlantically and what an experience must be like. For an oyster, watching a mother-daughter relationship, but also kind of undergoing its own travels and seeing the world. That was one story that kind of, took on its own life, but started from something real.
Yeah, I thought it was quirky, but also you kind of used the word refraction, right? There's something that you were seeing in yourself in the life of the oyster. But what was interesting for me is that the highlight of the oyster's life was to be eaten, to be consumed.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether that was, you know, something that's, I mean, obviously, you know, parallels can't go all the way.
Right.
Right? Like what was the highlight of your life? You know, so the life of the protagonist in the story kind of was in almost a mundane fashion, you know.
Yeah.
But the oyster was almost had a very vivid social life, you know, talking to the different vegetables and different things in the different fridges and things like that.
Yeah, I hadn't considered that. I think that's maybe one way that I think that added a contrast to the story that wasn't there before, when it was just, it's a gridlocked mother and daughter relationship, as sometimes happens in relationships where, you know, you're just at an impasse. But I think you're right, the oyster is almost on this little spiritual journey where it wants to be, you know, how did I put it, like, added a dash of soy sauce to and consumed, and it feels like it has a purpose to its life. And at the end of it, it thinks of itself as trying to have more adventures. So yeah, I think being able to play those two stories off each other and noting where they were dissimilar was helpful for that story.
I kind of felt like in your stories, your characters are quietly desperate. That and the fact that they are mostly Indian.
Yeah.
So maybe do you want to talk a little about that, the ethnicity and also the kind of motivation of your characters?
You know, you were talking about them having a lot of situational angst in your question. And I think, like a lot of writers, I'm always thinking about why people are doing what they're doing. And for me, something that's always fascinated me is that it is so obvious that the best way to live is to be fully satisfied and to have no regrets. But so few of us manage to do this, and I include myself in the majority, obviously, who can't do this. But so to me, I guess I'm very interested in that, like we all know, most of us know, that this is the way to be happier, but we are unable to do it. And so I tend to read a lot of human behavior and interactions through this lens of like yearning for something more. I think that's that ends up being the characters that I write. And as for my characters all being Indian, my protagonists all being Indian Singaporeans, I think that was, I mean, that's two things. One is that I felt most confident writing Indian Singaporeans. I felt that nobody was going to come back to me and be like, that is not how life is like for these people, because I felt like, you know what, I think I know what life is like. But the other thing was that, you know, until I read Bali Kaur Jaswal's books, I had never read English fiction in Singapore with Indian Singaporean protagonists. I just never read any. And so to me, it did also become something that I wanted to do. I wanted to represent Indian Singaporeans in English fiction in Singapore. And but to also represent them in a way that situated them kind of squarely in Singapore, not as some kind of like exotic culture in Singapore, but just to have Indian Singaporeans living their lives, having some experiences that are specific to Indians in Singapore, but having also just a lot of experiences that are just life in Singapore or as Singaporeans abroad. Yeah.
I really like what you said about viewing these characters of yours as sort of yearning for something greater. I think that was another great thing I saw in your stories, where the stories start from a premise, but you realize there's something quite a bit more beyond what the characters want. I think about Body on Board, where at first it seems like all this guy wants to do is go to Phuket and bring his brother's body back. But as the story unfolds, you realize there's so much more than that. He yearns for that lost connection with his brother when they used to be so close and just fell out of touch. You know, he's yearning for his daughter is next to him on the plane, and he's sort of so worried about how she's seeing all of this and the journey they're on. He's a little worried about is what his wife thinks. I think that's something that was so great about your characters, where they were consciously wanting one thing, but at the same time very much yearning for something beyond that.
Oh, thank you.
That's the teacher in Ennis analyzing your stories.
Thank you.
But just, you know, just to add about Body on Board,
I
think often we look at these terminal points of life, like a wedding, a birth, death, it's very absolute.
Yeah.
But what I guess what you did was trouble that notion of, of a death and kind of unpacked all the, you know, the situational improprieties around it, so to speak, you know, and kind of like go below the surface of things. So it's not, the death is not the end of that of that situation. I enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you.
Do you think writers today are bolder, more innovative? Do you think we are approaching the complexity of Western writing, so to speak, or are we forging our own path?
I would hesitate to generalize about that just from my limited vantage point, but I think what all writers have to do is write the stories that only they can write. And no one person is going to write the Singapore story or the Singapore experience. That's not a demand we can put on anyone. It's going to be something we do collectively, and that is just going to take time. I think for myself, you know, what something I care about a lot in writing is making visible invisible connections between people and places, and writing about feeling displaced, feeling like I have half myself in Singapore, half myself somewhere else. I used to view that as a disadvantage and kind of thought, you know, I'm never going to write a super Singaporean local story. I don't know. It's not my experience. And then I realized that's not my experience. I've just got to write the stories that I can write, and other people are going to write their stories. And together, that's where we're going to see, I think, the stories that we all are searching for and can tell.
And I guess this leads me kind of into my last question, which is what makes a good short story for both of you? You could answer either from the point of view as a writer or a reader or both.
Okay, from a point of view as a reader, so just as what kind of short stories you like. I like short stories that are funny. I like them to have something true at the heart of it that I can identify as true immediately when I read it. And you have said this, but I always like something unexpected to happen. So, you know, now you know what I'm striving for.
Yeah, I would agree with all of those. That sounds like a good time. I think another thing that, just to maybe add something that hasn't been said, I love when short stories can take a premise and run with it and sort of to see it to the end of as far as it goes. I think my first love in short stories was science fiction short stories, or kind of stories with more of a bent towards the fantastic. One that influenced me that I read, I think in sec one, was The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, which just takes this absurd situation.
I read that too.
Good. Just, without spoiling the ending, it's just there's a lottery once a year in this town, and everyone is in it, and you don't realize what's happening till the end. It's just such a great, and I also, around that time, discovered science fiction short stories, because in the school library, there was a shelf just for science fiction, and I was so grateful for that, because once I found one book I liked, I knew where all the other ones were. And so many short stories for sci-fi are just like, taking a premise and seeing how it logically plays out. I think there's a little bit of that influence in my stories. I was hoping there was. I have a story called Lee Kuan Yew Is Not Always the Answer, and it's part of the starts from a fantastic premise, which is about maybe 20 years in the future, we figured out how to implant these feeds in people's heads, and we can just sort of download information all the time. And it also takes place in a school, so it's looking at what's it like for the next generation to kind of come up and live in sort of a post-Lee Kuan Yew era of Singapore. And I took both those ideas and sort of tried to see them out as far as they could go. I think when short stories do that really well, there's a sense of the inevitable and the surprising. I think Flannery O'Connor talks about how she sees a decisive action towards the end of the story as an action of grace, where something breaks in, it's utterly true to the story and utterly surprising and unlike anything so far.
This is an excerpt from my short story, Lee Kuan Yew Is Not Always the Answer, from my forthcoming book, This Is Where I Won't Be Alone. The protagonist is a primary school history teacher. That night, my mom and I went out for dinner. We fought our way to the front of the queue for the bus, and we fought our way to get into the queue for the restaurant. None of this was strictly necessary, but whatever we do, my mom has to lock horns with other people to get any satisfaction. It makes her feel alive. She got to complain some more about how slow the flying food service robots were and how small the portions had become, which put her in quite a good mood. For the grand finale, we fought aggressively over the bill. "I'm working now, Mom," I said loudly. "Let me get it." "Save your money," she snapped. "Your children may need it for their education." At home, my mom presented me with a small durian cake, and I acted surprised, as though I hadn't seen the box appear in the refrigerator yesterday or smelled it every time I opened the refrigerator door. It was a wonderfully pungent cake. Our open carton of milk had already absorbed some of its flavor just by proximity. She cut us a finger-thin slice each. "I appreciate you spending your birthday with your old mom," she said. In the same neutral tone of voice, she added, "I suppose you didn't have a date or anything else planned." I said, "I was thinking of watching this year's Lee Kuan Yew special on Channel 5. "Ayo," she said despondently. "Even my friends don't watch those." "My students have been fascinated by him," I said. "I use my students as an excuse for a lot of what I do, being tired, being lazy, being busy, being childish. In fact, they probably make me better than I would be otherwise." I expected a sharp retort from my mom along those very lines, but instead she looked deep in thought. We sat on the sofa and I projected the documentary onto the wall. My mom also unfolded the ironing board and did the ironing, because she always has to outdo me. They made a different documentary every year for release each March 23rd. Yes, I was born the very day Lee Kuan Yew died, March 23rd, 2015. I don't mean to imply that I feel a special connection to his ghost or anything like that, just that I've always been conscious of having been born into a different era. In the past, our leaders fought their battles to determine who we were not. We were not a British colony. We were not a communist state. We were not part of Malaysia. The struggle now has been to define what we are. Adolescence, we can relate to that, especially those of us who haven't quite figured our way out of it yet.
Okay, this is from the opening of my short story, Funeral Gifts, from my collection, Regrettable Things That Happened Yesterday. And the protagonist is a 14-year-old boy. It was my uncle who first made the discovery. As his father's only son, the less than pleasant task of ceremonially bathing his corpse had fallen to him. He had wanted to outsource this particular labor of love to the casket company, but my grandmother insisted he do it. When he turned his father over to wash his back, he yelled, "Drop my grandfather's lifeless body on the bathroom floor," and ran from the room. I was ordered to retrieve him, and so was in a position to confirm it. Tata had a telltale tattoo on his left buttock, identifying him as a key leader of a group I had only heard about in whispers at school until now, BP Pete, or BPP. Funnily enough, this was the same group that was said to be behind the Parang slashings in Bukit Panjang Park the week before. I mentioned this to my grandmother and received a stinging slap across the face. "Don't be an idiot," she told me. "Only Chinese people have gangs." She assumed no more would be said on the subject to lend the notion any credence, so when my mother and uncle sat themselves around the table to discuss what, if anything, should be done about this surprising revelation, my grandmother entered a state of denial that would have been acceptable had it not also been belligerent. From her wheelchair, she wrapped each of her children across the legs under the table for daring to suggest such an alternate reality, and would have started on me too if I hadn't cottoned on and addressed her only from afar. My grandmother bellowed that her good husband would be turning over in his grave, had he already been in it, if he could hear what his ungrateful children were now saying about him. Her husband, an honest man who worked hard to provide for their family. She insisted that everyone had misinterpreted what they had seen, that it was not a tattoo but a birthmark or a liver spot contoured by the deep wrinkles of 9 decades on this earth. What did they know of old age and how a buttock might look after 90 years, she demanded angrily of her children. She asked to be shown the mark to disprove this theory once and for all, but then started screaming when my uncle approached the corpse to lift his veshti, saying there was no end to the disgrace her evil children would put their dead father through. She might have continued down this path indefinitely for all I know if the gangsters hadn't started arriving.
And this has been Macro Moments. You can read or listen to more of our stories on our website, macro.life. Until next time, thanks for listening.